Part 3. Genes. The Mystery in DNA. Chapter 7. Siberia. Across both South and North America, DNA studies have revealed that at some point in the remote past, in some unknown location or locations, the ancestors of Native Americans interbred with an archaic and now extinct human species. Only recently discovered, and closely related to the more famous Neanderthals, who also produced offspring with our ancestors, geneticists have named this species the Denisovans. Insufficient sampling has been done to establish exact levels, but the current estimate is that 0.13 to 0.17% of Native American DNA is of Denisovan origin, with indications in the data that some indigenous groups, for example the Piapoco of Colombia and Venezuela in South America and the Ojibwa of northeastern North America, can be expected to have higher levels of Denisovan DNA than others. We know about the Denisovans because of paradigm-busting discoveries at the eponymous Denisova Cave in a region of rugged highlands known as the Altai at the extreme south of the Russian Federal District of Siberia. Bordered by Mongolia, China, and Kazakhstan, and extending from the Ural Mountains in the west to the Kamchatka Peninsula and the Federal District of Chukotka, more than 5,000 kilometers to the east, Siberia covers 13.1 million square kilometers, around 77% of the total geographical area of Russia. The Urals form a prominent part of the dividing line between Europe and Asia. Kamchatka and Chukotka stand at the junction of the Pacific and Arctic Oceans, with Kamchatka's coast washed by the waters of the Bering Sea, while Chukotka commands the Bering Strait. Presently, 82 kilometers wide between Cape Dezhnev in Chukotka and Alaska's Cape Prince of Wales, during the last ice age, the strait was drained by lowered sea levels, and a tundra-covered land bridge, Beringia, connected Chukotka with Alaska. In other words, at that time, Europe, Asia, and the Americas were one continuous landmass. Should you have had the inclination and the stamina, there were certain periods when it would have been technically possible to walk from the Atlantic coast of what is now Spain, across Western and Eastern Europe to the Urals, through Siberia, across Beringia, into Alaska and Canada, down through the ice-free corridor dividing the two primary sheets of the North American ice cap, into the United States, and then through Central America into South America, as far as Tierra del Fuego, before again encountering another ocean, a narrow one during the Ice Age, when Antarctica was much larger. No investigation of the human stories in the Americas, therefore, can ignore the role of Siberia as a crossroads in the migrations of our ancestors. Moreover, despite the fact that only a tiny fraction of its vast area has yet been sampled by archaeologists, we already know that anatomically modern humans were present in both Western and Arctic Siberia at least as far back as 45,000 years ago. We know, too, that DNA studies have revealed close genetic relationships between Native Americans and Siberians that speak to a deep and ancient connection. Anomalies in the data. With a few notable exceptions, it was the consensus view of archaeologists and anthropologists during the period of Clovis' first dominance that the Americas were settled exclusively by the overland route from Siberia via Beringia and southward through the ice-free corridor. Despite the collapse of Clovis I, this remains the consensus view today. However, it has been finessed to accommodate the discovery of ever more sites in North and South America predating the opening of the ice-free corridor that therefore could not possibly have been settled by migration through it. In addition, several subsequent studies have pointed out that for much of its duration, long stretches of the supposed ice-free corridor would have been completely uninhabitable and thus most unpromising territory for a lengthy migration. To explain how migration might have taken place at all, therefore, and to account for the growing mass of archaeological and genetic evidence suggesting that humans had been in the Americas, isolated from Asia, for thousands of years before Clovis, two theories have recently found favor. 1. A Beringian standstill model, within which scholars continue to debate, whereby, in the simplest terms, having crossed the land bridge into Alaska, perhaps as much as 30,000 years ago, the migrants found their southward progress blocked by the conjoined Cordilleran and Laurentide ice sheets. More or less simultaneously, their return to Siberia was interdicted by the expansion of glaciers in Siberia's Verkhoyansk Range and in Alaska's Mackenzie River Valley. Their descendants were therefore obliged to spend between 10,000 and 20,000 years stranded in Beringia before further climate shifts allowed them to spread south into the Americas. During this incubation period, the now isolated population experienced certain genetic changes that would distinguish them from their Northeast Asian ancestors at the level of DNA, while at the same time confirming their close ancestral relatedness. 2. A coastal migration theory, whereby the first migrants were boat people who crossed the narrow, island-strewn neck of the North Pacific from Northeast Asia into the Americas. This coastal theory relies heavily on the so-called kelp highway migration model, which notes that the deglaciation of North America's Pacific coast presented migrants with a region rich in kelp and other aquatic resources that could support their journeys. The coastal model also relies on the unarguable presence, though scarce, of early Paleolithic Northwest American archaeological sites. Such coasting could have been undertaken at any time during lowered Ice Age sea levels, particularly when Beringia was exposed, could have been achieved with extremely simple technology such as rafts and coracles, and often would not have required the migrants to lose sight of land. Since we know that other ancient peoples migrated by sea as much as 65,000 years ago, for example, the crossing of the Timor Straits by the first migrants to Australia, there can be no objection in principle to the Americas being inhabited in the same way. All this seems thoroughly reasonable, and I have no doubt that both things happened. Island-hopping migrants in simple vessels, suitable for short, open-water crossings, did indeed contribute significantly to the peopling of the Americas. Similarly, one need look no further than Jacques Cinq-Mars' excavations demonstrating a human presence 24,000 years ago at Bluefish Caves in the Yukon to confirm that there is truth to the Beringian standstill model too. But are these revised and finessed models, currently very much in vogue with archaeologists, sufficient to explain all the complexities and anomalies in the data that science offers on the peopling of the Americas? Sergei and Olga. In early September 2017, a couple of months before visiting Topper with Al Goodyear, and a month before meeting Tom Demaray at the Nat in San Diego, Santha and I applied for Russian visas and declared our destination as Denisova Cave in the Altai. The visas were expensive. The dauntingly opaque application forms took a great while to fill out, and in the general fog of bureaucratic time-wasting, we began to wonder if we might have to postpone the trip until the spring of 2018, when the Siberian winter would have come and gone. Russia is more efficient than it looks, however, and we had our visas within a week. Still, it was going to have to be a very quick visit, with a big American journey planned from the end of September through until close to the end of November. There was no time for sightseeing, therefore, when we flew to Moscow on September 12th, overnighted at Sheremetyevo, and caught a connecting flight the next morning to Novosibirsk, the Siberian capital, a four-hour flight and four time zones east of Moscow. After landing and collecting our bags, Santa and I were met groundside by our local connection, Sergei Kurgin. I say connection because you have to have one if you're going to travel in Russia. You can't just get up and go. Some solid citizen or business or tour operator must take responsibility for you and officially invite you, and you must have a pre-arranged and pre-planned itinerary to pre-approved destinations, or your visa won't be issued, nor, if you somehow manage to slip through the net, will any hotel accommodate you on your route. Sergei owns a small private travel business called Sibalp, and I'd contacted him on the internet to help set up the trip. Negotiations were complicated by the fact that he spoke no English. He was perplexed that I spoke no Russian. but various translators got involved, and a deal was done. Sergei would drive us the 600 kilometers or so from Novosibirsk to Topolnoye, a township in the Altai, where we would stay with a local family while we visited the cave about 20 kilometers farther on. When we were done, he would drive us back to Novosibirsk. He would arrange all accommodation en route and find us an interpreter without whom we would be unable to speak to anyone. Joining Sergei at the airport to meet us, therefore, was Olga Votrina, the bilingual student from Novosibirsk State University, who'd be interpreting for us. Novosibirsk is a city of monotone drabness, with an oppressive, regimented, Soviet-era feel to it. Olga was cheerful and nervous, wanting very much to be a good interpreter and guide. Thick-set and grizzled, Sergei was an older man, perhaps in his 70s, but solid, gruff and strong. He owned a four-wheel drive Mitsubishi minivan that had at some point been imported, used, from Japan, and thus had its steering wheel on the wrong side. It was battered and creaky, with a pronounced and disconcerting tug to the right. But as he drove us through the geometric grid of Novosibirsk's streets, Sergei assured us it was up to the journey ahead. Our hotel was in the academic quarter, a stone's throw from the Museum of the Peoples of Siberia. We spent the following morning viewing artifacts from Denisova Cave, and in the afternoon we set off on the long road south beneath leaden, wide-open skies across a remarkably flat landscape, relieved by patches of muted color, black earth here, green field there, rank upon rank of hay bales set upon yellowing stubble, marching toward the remote horizon. There was something lulling and dreamlike about the whole scene. I drifted off to sleep, and when I awoke, darkness had fallen. Sergei was downing a can of Red Bull and gripping the juddering wheel tightly as he weaved in and out of the surprisingly heavy Siberian traffic. Despite his disadvantageous position on the wrong side of the road, he was doing well, and by midnight we had two-thirds of the journey behind us and stopped to sleep in the town of Bisk. We were back on the road again early the next morning, a much brighter and more cheerful day, and drove 65 kilometers further south to Belokurika, near which there were rumored to be some intriguing megaliths that Sergei believed he would be able to locate. Quite different from the flatlands of the day before, we were now on the borders of the Altai Mountains and spent the next several hours in the region of Mount Moknatia, driving off-road through fields, circling likely-looking hills covered in outcrops of granitic rocks, and asking farmers for directions. Eventually, we met a man who knew the couple, Vladimir Ilyich and Raisa Stepanov, both in their late 60s, who were said to have discovered the alleged megaliths. An hour later, we were sharing bread and honey with them in their home in the village of Nizhnikamenka. This was followed, quaintly, by a tour of their vegetable garden and an invitation, how could we refuse, to pick raspberries and blackberries from the briars growing in abundance there. It was early afternoon by the time Vladimir and Raisa, their daughter Svetlana, and their strapping young grandson Maxim all crammed into Sergei's groaning minivan with us. It seemed we had been in roughly the right place all morning, missing the sight only by about half a mile. I was excited that we were finally going to see it, but as we set out again on the bumpy off-road drive, Vladimir advised me to lower my expectations. In his opinion, the media coverage had been much ado about nothing, and the so-called megaliths he was about to show us were natural rock formations. Behind the headlines. The information that there might be ancient megaliths here in the Altai, quite close to Denisova Cave, had come to me by way of a news item in the English-language edition of the Siberian Times, published on May 8, 2017. The rather compelling headline reported the discovery of dragon and griffin megaliths dating back to the end of the Ice Age. Archaeological researchers, named as Alexander and Ruslan Peresyolkov, were cited, suggesting the enigmatic monuments were likely to be at least 12,000 years old, but that precise dating would be impossible until the culture that created them is identified. This is always a problem with monuments carved out of stone. The cutting and shaping of the stone itself cannot be directly dated. What is needed is an archaeological context in which the monument is set, preferably with carbon-datable organic materials in situ. And from these, the age of the monument may then usually be inferred. Since there was no excavation at Mount Mognatia, however, no context had yet been established, and the archaeological researchers were surely right that precise dating was presently impossible. But what sort of archaeological researchers had even these provisional assessments reported in the Siberian Times come from? The news item gave no information about their credentials, nor could I find any online. The only clue, and not necessarily a reliable one, was in the comments section, where Ruslan Peresyolkov was described as a little-known web designer and not an archaeologist, not even an amateur. We humans are hardwired for pattern recognition, so it's not surprising that people all over the world frequently detect patterns in nature that they believe are the work of men, but later, on close examination by cooler and more experienced heads, prove to be entirely natural. This happens particularly often with eroded outcrops of rock, notably with certain types of granite that can crack and weather in ways that seem obviously designed, but in fact are not. Archaeologists are trained to be skeptical of such simulacra, and their default position will be that a rock is just a rock until there is really hard and compelling evidence that humans shaped it. Needless to say, if the rock in question ended up as a granite statue of Ramesses II, the context and the style, plus any hieroglyphs engraved upon it, would tell you all you need to know. Granite boulders that have been sitting on an unexcavated hillside in the Altai for unknown thousands of years, however, are an entirely different proposition, and I wasn't inclined to take any opinion of them on trust, whether expressed by a fully qualified archaeologist or by a web designer, or for that matter, by Vladimir. I was just curious and literally in the area, so why not take a look for myself? Messages of Earth and Sky. We drove as close as possible to a rugged hill that I recognized from our earlier search and trudged across a field to get to it. Raisa, who'd recently had hip replacement surgery, remained behind in the Mitsubishi. But Vladimir, Svetlana, and Maxim joined us, the young man kindly offering to carry Santha's weighty bag of cameras. We reached the base of the hill and began a long clamber up a steep slope, thickly carpeted with wild grasses, heather, and clinging brambles. Svetlana warned us that the area was infested with snakes. "Always look before you step," she said. The afternoon was sunny and surprisingly warm, and the sky an eggshell blue with a few soft white clouds up high. At one point, pausing for breath, I turned and looked back. Behind us, dotted with lower mounds and hills, was a patchwork quilt of greens and yellows, spread out for 20 miles across the floor of a glorious valley. It was through this valley and around these hills that we had spent the morning fruitlessly driving. Now, from this new vantage point, I saw it was bounded to the east by the humped, tawny backs of a distant range of mountains. I watched for a moment the shadows of the clouds painting their own patterns across the landscape, struck by the poignant, fleeting beauty of it all. We resumed the climb, close now to our first objective, an outcrop of rough, deeply fissured and fractured natural granitic bedrock, visible because the otherwise omnipresent undergrowth could find no purchase on it. It was red-gray in color, about 50 meters in length and 20 wide, obviously an integral part of the hillside itself, sloping at the same steep angle and surmounted at its upper end by a dense cluster of large boulders. "The tail of the dragon," said Vladimir skeptically, pointing to the downslope sector of the outcrop. "And the head," he indicated the boulders. At first, I didn't get it. But once we'd climbed above the outcrop and could look back and down on it, a figure began to emerge. I could just about make sense of the tail, and I could see the head clearly, but not as the head of a dragon. Viewed very slightly turned in profile from where I stood, it seemed to me much more to resemble the head and the left eye of some great serpent. I was, of course, already sensitized and preconditioned to recognize the form of a serpent in the outcrop, perhaps a little by Svetlana's warning of snakes in the grass in these parts, but also in an even more visceral way by what I had learned at Serpent Mound in Ohio. The language that Serpent Mound speaks is hard to understand from the technological materialist point of view. That view, so dominant and widespread today, is one in which there is no such thing as spirit, and the earth is simply dead matter to be mined, exploited, and consumed. By contrast, the ancient people to whom Serpent Mound addressed itself in clear and ringing tones not only knew that all things, both animate and inanimate, were imbued with spirit, but also lived close to the earth and were in touch with her rhythms and awake to the manifold messages and signals and ciphers by which she spoke to them. Among these were perfectly natural features of the landscape through which, whether on account of their special appearance or location or alignment or some other remarkable quality, the spirit of the earth could manifest wisdom, beauty, and teachings. Serpent Mound is one of these Manitou, and we saw how the presence there of a natural serpentine ridge with a natural serpent-like head oriented towards the setting point of the sun on the summer solstice offered an epiphany to the ancients of the union of earth and sky, and was their cue to create the great effigy mound that now commands the site and still swallows the sun on the longest day of the year. Nearly 3 months had passed since that summer solstice at Serpent Mound. Now the autumn equinox was just a few days away, and I was very far from America, yet in a part of the world directly linked to the migrations of the ancestors of the first Americans. I was therefore not averse, in principle, to considering the possibility that this peculiar formation in the Siberian Altai might be another earth serpent, enhanced and embellished by human beings, attentive to the ciphers of nature. But it equally might be how Vladimir saw it, simply one of those accidents of nature that give the illusion of a human hand at work. From the rough bearings I was able to take, though I offered no guarantees, it seemed to me that the serpent's head, I could not see it as a dragon, was oriented more or less due west, and thus aligned to the setting point of the sun on both the spring and the autumn equinoxes. About 2 meters high and 4 meters long to the base of the neck, the head was massive and possessed a distinctive brow ridge overlying the firmly defined left eye. Moving forward, I saw the mouth was present, the jaws clearly demarcated and slightly ajar. There was a peculiar cleft in the front of the lower jaw. Much of this, apart from that odd gap, was moderately serpent-like, but only on the left side of the serpent's head. When I scrambled round to view the right side, it was as though I were suddenly looking at a completely different structure, not a serpent at all, but a megalithic wall built from 10 hefty, eroded, but precisely interlinked granite blocks. Somehow, whether by nature or by human beings, a structure had been created that appeared to be a wall on one side and the head of a serpent on the other. If this was done by humans, I reasoned, then surely they would have wanted to make both sides look the same. On the other hand, if it was done by nature, how were we to account for the blocks, and even more difficult, the combination of blocks and serpent simulacrum? Either on its own might be explained by weathering, but for both to occur together in such a limited area seemed much less likely. A few hundred meters farther up the hill, the so-called Griffin shed no greater light on the problem. Another rocky outcrop was involved, this time oriented south, and into its granite face, 3 meters tall from the base of its neck and 5 meters wide from the tip of its beak to the crest on the back of its head, was carved the likeness of some immense, mythical, hook-beaked bird, hence its designation as a griffin. Natural? Or modified by human hands? An argument against it being man-made is the way that the lower part of the beak is unfinished and unseparated from the surrounding bedrock. An argument in favor of human enhancements of the natural bedrock is that directly beneath the crest are three small alcoves set side by side step fashion, It's difficult to envisage how nature alone could have achieved this effect. And besides, there are similar rock-hewn structures in the high Andes of South America that are indisputably man-made. As we climbed back down the hill, Vladimir remained unpersuaded, but I wasn't so sure. And a few days later, after returning to Novosibirsk, where we had access to fast internet again, I searched for information about the region's snakes. What I learned was that there are 6 species of serpent in the Altai, and that the largest, most venomous, and most respected of these by far is Gloideus halis, the Siberian pit viper. In my opinion, its clearly defined eyes, its brow ridges, the general shape of its head, and the way that its forked tongue is sometimes thrust out, allowing it to hang down over the middle of its lower jaw, creating the illusion of a cleft in that jaw, are all rather closely mimicked by the granite features of the earth serpent we trudged up and down that hill in the Altai to inspect. But does that make it the remnant of a megalithic ice age civilization? Or even a megalith at all? Certainly not. And the same goes for the griffin. Yet they are set in the heart of a region of mystery where previously held certitudes about humanity's past have been shattered by the discoveries at Denisova Cave. After saying our goodbyes to Vladimir, Raisa, Svetlana, and Maxim, as evening fell over that sunny Siberian day, we drove the remaining 80 kilometers south to Topolnoye, only 20 kilometers from the cave. There, another friendly, down-to-earth couple waited to welcome us into their home and feed us not only bread and honey, but milk fresh from the cow and other delicious, nourishing things. Entering the Denisovans' secret valley. Our new hosts were Papin Asatrian, dark-haired and bearded, a migrant to the Altai from Armenia when it was still part of the former Soviet Union, and his blonde Siberian wife, Elena Derenskik. They were both in their 50s, their children long ago grown up and fled the nest. Like most of the other 1,100 inhabitants of Topolnoye, they had regular jobs. Papin was a builder, Elena an accountant, but also owned a few cows and goats and a fair-sized vegetable garden, growing enough food, it seemed, to make them self-sufficient in most essentials. That night, over a fantastic dinner, I joked that if 21st century civilization were to collapse, it would be people like Elena and Papin who would survive, not people like me who've never hunted a deer or grown a cabbage or milked a cow in their lives. "Don't worry," Elena said. "We will save you." Some eye-watering local vodka was served, followed by a surprisingly comfortable night's sleep on bunk beds and a sunlit morning, greeted with an ample breakfast of eggs, bread, jams, fruit, coffee, and a jug of clotted cream. Then Sergei fired up the Mitsubishi, and we were off along a reasonably good road, graded but not paved, running beside the Anui River, fast-flowing with patches of white water, reminding me of the trout streams my grandfather used to fish in the Scottish Highlands, where I would sometimes accompany him when I was a child. For Santha, the landscape had more of a Tolkien-esque quality. Guarded by distant, soaring peaks, we were in a deep, hidden valley, sometimes darkly shadowed and enclosed, sometimes opening out suddenly and unexpectedly into undulating hills and hummocks, where coppices of mixed autumnal woodland overlooked bright meadows at the river's edge. For geologists, the landform here is known as karst, a special type of topography created by the random dissolution over millions of years of soluble, usually sedimentary rocks, in this case, limestone. Like all such landscapes, it is characterized by extensive underground drainage systems, sinkholes and caves, of which Denisova Cave is just one among many. Some are already known to contain ancient human remains and artifacts, but far more have not yet been properly studied or studied at all by archaeologists. Sergei pulled the Mitsubishi over and parked beneath a freshly minted National Monument sign, painted brown and helpfully labeled Denisova Cave in both Russian and English. Narrow here between low banks, the river was behind us, forested to its edge on the far side, and with a saw-toothed range of mountains rising in the distance beyond. On our bank, the trees had been cleared, and in front of us, across the road, rising steeply for about 200 meters, was a grassy slope, with a wooden stairway constructed on its upper part, leading to a rugged, silver-grey carved cliff, at the base of which gaped the black, almost square mouth of the cave. It is, arguably, the most important archaeological site in the world. And yet not a soul was here, not a scientist, not a tourist, not even a guard. The whole place was eerily deserted, silent but for birdsong and the gentle rustle of wind through the grass, marking time under the sun as it had done for millennia, the guardian of many mysteries still. Not that I minded the solitude and the peace. What a privilege, I thought, what a gift, to be here on this bright morning and to have this ancient place to ourselves.